Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we begin the show today with the first hour of science, science literacy. There's all kinds of things. It's really an interesting report, I think, that Bassam Shakashiri is going to give us on sulfuric acid and why there are some problems associated with it, which I did not know about, and I'm going to be really eager to hear what he's got to say. Bassam Shakashiri, of course, back with us, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison, national proponent for science and science education. And as I said, lots of news regarding greenhouse gases, the sulfuric acid. We can take a look at science literacy with him. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. How important is science education in the U.S. in your mind? What problems do you see in the science area? Give us a call, the number 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And Bassam Shakashiri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always happy to be with you and the listening audience, Larry. Thank you.
Let's start with science literacy. You've talked a lot about the importance of science literacy and how important it is for the general public, to appreciate the contribution of science in our daily lives. What's your view of the state of science literacy in the country?
The science literacy in the country is fairly good, but frankly, not good enough, Larry. Society increasingly depends on science and on technology, and this is why it's essential for the well-being of everyone in our society, all communities, all members of the society, to develop an appreciation of science, what the benefits of technology are, and also the potential risks associated with these advances. So, what is the level of appreciation? What is the level of understanding of these tremendous advances in science and technology that we enjoy now? That is something that is really potentially troubling, because I don't feel that there is sufficient appreciation of the role of science and technology in our well-being. So I I'm an advocate of having widespread science literacy. Science and technology, Larry, are the engines that drive our economy, and they contribute to our well-being. Science literacy is an attitude. It's like personal hygiene. You have to work at it. You have to be engaged in it. You have to be involved. You have to ask questions. You have to converse. And if the scientists don't come around to telling you what they're doing and how important it is what they're doing, we should be asking them. It's not only the responsibility of scientists to engage in conversations about science literacy. It is the responsibility of everyone to ask scientists, not only about their own research, but about the general well-being of society as it relates to advances in science and technology. I want to say one more time. Science literacy is an attitude. It's like personal hygiene, as I said. You just do it. You live it. You engage in meaningful, respectful conversation. So the state of science literacy in the country is in need of much, much improvement. And it is the responsibility of those of us in science and in technology to do more. It is also the responsibility of everyone else to engage us by asking us to explain, to share, to discuss, to review, to evaluate the benefits and the potential harm that could arise from advances in science and technology.
I know you oversee the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy. Maybe you could talk about what that organization is doing now.
The Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy, housed at UW-Madison, is basically my research and public engagement group. It started out in the chemistry department a long time ago, and it's expanded to include conversations about science, conversations about technology, and to promote literacy in science, mathematics, and technology with a dual purpose. One is to have these conversations, and the second purpose is to attract future generations to careers in research, in teaching, and in public service. I want to emphasize careers in doing research, in teaching, and also in being engaged with the public. So what we do at the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy is we live our philosophy by engaging individuals and groups, both locally, around the state, across the country, around the world, actually. The main purpose is to trigger cerebral and emotional connections that really heighten the joy of learning. But more importantly, is the action that we each take after what we learn. So basically, this is briefly and succinctly what the Wisconsin Initiative for Science Literacy is all about.
And, you know, you believe, and I how many times have I seen you with that T-shirt, science is fun? That philosophy, you've been trying to spread that philosophy for your whole career.
Well, the joy of learning is not only satisfying personally, but it is related to how I and others interact with each other. And when we say science is fun, well, I'm not talking about cheap thrills. I'm talking about being intellectually stimulated and being emotionally rewarded. And I'm talking about engagement, conversations, respectful conversations. The joy of learning is personal, but it is also a community. It's also related to our interactions with the community. So, yes, fun in the best sense of the word. You can't be serious unless you have fun. You know that.
Well, you know, here we are at the end of the school year, and of course, and I know there are many chemistry, many students graduating in chemistry and the sciences. What do you think the job market for college graduates with science degrees is right now?
It's the job market is not so bad, but it can be better. There are concerns in terms of how advances in technology, specifically artificial intelligence, is affecting the market, the employment market. So people with a bachelor's degree, a master's degrees, PhD degrees, continue to be sought by industry, but there are concerns about how some of the functions, about the role that they would play when they're employed in industry. So that's something to really, really be concerned about. As far as academic institutions' employment, we know that the population profile is changing, and who knows what the need is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years for teachers, for college professors, for university researchers. But that should not deter us from insisting on having high-quality offerings in our schools, colleges, and universities to prepare us either for a technical career or for careers where we appreciate and try to understand the significant roles of science and technology in what we do. So I remain optimistic.
Well, and as I've been reading, there has been, you know, issues in terms of research and that sort of thing at the university and, you know, that level. But in the private level, there's been a bit of an uptick in certain science fields where the opportunities are expanding a bit.
Yes, and they're expanding because we know more as a result of scientific research, and we have ways to apply what we have learned for the benefit of society. Yes, that's true.
Nick in Green Bay has a comment or so for us. Let's go there. Nick, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. I love your guest. Your guest is an amazing guy. I got three kids, and I'm into science huge. I'm a ham operator, and I try to get the kids to talk on shortwave. They've got no interest. I said, well, we could talk to this space station going across. No interest at all. And it really disappoints me because, you know, science is amazing, but they've just got no interest. And I'm very enthusiastic about science, and they just care less. It's just, it's a real bummer, and, you know, there's nothing I can do. You can bring the horse to water, but you just can't make them drink, and it's just really upsets me, but...
Wait, Nick. Let me interrupt you. What are they interested in? Have you engaged in conversations with them about their own interest and try to have an understanding of what they're interested in and how? And maybe you can successfully and correctly point out that whatever they're interested in has deep connections and relations to science and technology.
Yeah. They're interested in sports, lots of sports.
How about the science of sports? Is nutrition important for someone to do well in sports? Is exercise important? Is getting enough sleep important? We have lots of research that has continues to go on in all of these three areas I just mentioned. There are many more, and they're all scientific based, and they help us understand how to enjoy sports, and help us understand how we do things together when we go to a ball game or when we play, and how to be protective of ourselves as we do a sports activity. You know, enough sleep, enough nutrition, proper rest, not overdo the exercise, what to do if there's an injury. All of this is related to advances in science, Nick.
And I would just add to that, if they're mathematically inclined, some of the better paying jobs in baseball, for example, at the managerial level or at the higher levels, is the statistics that are being processed on every player and under what conditions they might hit better, or pitching, what kinds of pitches. There are all kinds of mathematical equations going on here to figure out every last move that a player makes.
Excellent point, Larry, because mathematical literacy is part of what I'm talking about, science literacy. It's easy for people to look up the batting average of a player. That's statistics. And how does that happen? And what does it mean? And how are they collected? How are they processed? And now, with advances in technology, we have many, many, many more pieces of data. One question I have is, what do we do with all these pieces of data? So there's all kinds of ways to talk about this and to do to learn from it.
Nick, I hope you do that. I hope you take some time and think about your kids' interests and what kind of a science spin can you put on it. I think you have some examples to work from here. And appreciate your call very much. Always good talking with you. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, Emeritus Professor of Chemistry at UW-Madison and the William T. Evue Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. What are your thoughts on science and science education? Other questions for Bassam? Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have science and science education on our minds today as we talk with Bassam Shakashiri, professor, emeritus professor of chemistry at UW-Madison. It's great to have him back. Questions for him or a comment to share, I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. But Sam, I mentioned at the start of the show, sulfuric acid. And the price of gasoline has spiked since the U.S. war in Iran. But there is another product that's now harder to get from that part of the world, and that's sulfuric acid. Now, why would that be a problem?
Sulfuric acid is a critical component of the gross domestic product, because sulfuric acid is the most used chemical in all the processes that we have in society. Sulfuric acid, the chemical formula for it is H2SO4, and it is a strong acid in water. It is made by combining sulfur, the element sulfur, with oxygen to make sulfur dioxide and sulfur trioxide. And then it's the sulfur trioxide, when it is combined with water, that produces the sulfuric acid. So the disruption in the supply of sulfuric acid, as I said, it's the world's most common chemical. The disruption in the supply has consequences. These consequences, I'll just give you a couple. There are higher fertilizer costs now. They're triggered because less sulfuric acid is being produced. Why is it being less produced? Because the world's supply of sulfur and sulfuric acid goes through the Strait of Hormuz. Need I say more about that?
Mm-hmm.
It is important that we continue to have a good supply worldwide of sulfuric acid. It cuts across agricultural sector, the agriculture sector in society. When fertilizer prices go up, which is what is happening because there's less fertilizer being produced, because there's less sulfuric acid available, then the farmers are forced to reduce the amount of fertilizer they put on the fields. And because when that happens and you have lower crop yields, and that's especially true for grains like corn, rice, and wheat, that are very highly dependent on manufactured fertilizers, including, you know, especially the ones that have ammonia. So reducing the amount of fertilizer available worldwide, but even by a small fraction, it significantly reduces the harvest, the size of the harvest, and then there's potentially less food available for all of us. There are other effects too. Farmers sometimes they switch crops. When you switch crops, you need different varieties of nutrients, and all of these are, you know, based on chemical manufactured chemicals that have to do with sulfuric acid. Yeah. So that's
one good example, and it's going to affect those parts of the world or those areas, even I guess some areas of the U.S. where lower income folks are going to have the highest set of problems.
Yes, sulfuric acid is the most commonly used chemical in the world in all of the processes that affect manufacturing, agriculture, and so on.
Well, Jim in Onalaska has something for us. Let's go there. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. I think science students should also have a heavy dose of political science, because you can be the greatest scientist, but if you don't know how our politics work, you're not real effective.
Huh. So political science, I would say communications, too, as somebody, a faculty member from the Department of Life Sciences communication, I would say that as well.
It's so critical to become educated, that to develop skills to learn, but also skills to relate to others. And communication is a form of relating to others. And all communications have to be encouraged, they have to be improved, they have to be practiced, and they have to be done. And so I wonder if you would make this suggestion to your local school board. We should engage with our local school boards. We should engage with the departments of public instruction, not only in Wisconsin, but across the listening area, to see to it that we have high-quality educational offerings that prepare our students to live not only well, but to live well with each other. And that is the essence of communication, is how we live and interact with each other. And I want to say one more time, Larry, all the interactions we have with each other should be respectful, should be based on trust, and should be based on confidence in what we say. Not that we are trying to tell everybody to be like to behave in a certain way, except that our behavior should be inviting to others. So we listen to each other, we talk with each other, not talk at each other. And if we have differences of opinion, fine. Let's air them. Let's discuss them. We need to be respectful, and we need to be trusting in ourselves and in others, so that we have good conversations. And as I've said on your program before, Larry, and I say it all the time, the first purpose of a conversation is to have another conversation.
Yeah. You do say that. And, you know, just to add, and to Jim's point on political science, when I was in high school, even in grade school, I had a pretty good civics class. And I read recently, kind of to my dismay, that civics is being less offered in schools these days. And understanding your government and how things function, in my mind, is important for an informed society.
It is, and we should be concerned about the quality of teaching in our high schools and our colleges and universities, of the sciences, of mathematics, but also of the arts and the other parts of the humanities. Because science is not the answer to all the questions that we have as human beings. We need to engage in really effective ways to live with each other, not only exist with each other, but to live with each other. That's so crucial, especially nowadays that the discourse is at a level which is less than civil. In that regard, I also want to say something about social media. So social media can be put to good use, but excessive dependence on social media can result in less on the part of users, less paying attention to what's important. If you look at so many different things in a short period of time, in a minute or 5 minutes, and you go on for hours, what is it that you remember? What is it that, what action are you going to take other than keep on scrolling? So we need to really be sure not only about what goes on in the school, in the classroom, but what we do individually as we enjoy the beautiful world that we live in, and we contribute to the well-being of everyone in our society.
Mm. Carol emailed to say that a good example of interesting science for people of all ages can be found in the YouTube show Huge If True. It's hosted by journalist Cleo Abrams. And I know that it kind of features on, rather than what's going wrong with the world, the show takes sort of an optimistic approach, kind of breaks down complex cutting-edge topics like artificial intelligence or genetic engineering and sustainable energy into, I guess you could say, highly accessible and highly polished or highly produced stories.
There are many good examples, like the one you mentioned, the caller mentioned, that Carol mentioned. And then there's NOVA. There are programs on PBS Wisconsin, not only for kids, PBS Wisconsin kids and for adults. And Larry, your show over the decades has always dealt with topics and matters related to science. I don't want to go through the whole list, but whether it's people from the health sector, or people from agriculture, people from in every sector. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. You garden talk, calling all pets. It's just you. I really salute you, Larry, for having such a wide variety of guests that enrich us as we listen to you and to the guests. And you've had lots of science and technology programs. Thank you, Larry.
Well, thank you, Bassam. I appreciate that very much. And it's, I'll be gone in end of June, but the shows and the topics we cover are not going to change. We're going to keep that going, and I'm hoping for many, many years to come, for sure. Dennis in Stoughton, he had a kind of a question for you. He couldn't stay with us, but he quoted Carl Sagan as saying, "We're all made of star stuff." And Dennis asked, to what extent is that true? How did the element involve and precipitate out of the universe? Although that's a simple question, I'm sure you can answer it about 400 hours.
Well, that's a good way to start a conversation. And, yeah. and thank you, Dennis, for this question. Yes, when we speak with each other, we use metaphors. And sometimes the metaphor, has a certain basic validity. So our bodies are made of chemical elements that have combined with each other for molecules, small molecules, large molecules. All of these components can be viewed euphemistically as being. As being dust, so understanding the origins of life, understanding who we are, realizing that every time we make a new discovery, we have questions about it. Every time we use a new technology, we should be responsible in using it. All of this is fascinating to me, how all of these transformations that we go through as individuals and as communities, all related to chemical reactions going on in the brain and the rest of the body. So, yes, there was also a song not too long ago, right? Maybe some decades ago, "Dust in the Wind," right? Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Do you remember that? All we are is dust in the wind, or something like that. That gives me a pause to think and to contemplate about the meaning of life and what we are doing here on the surface of the planet and how privileged we are to be alive and how we can interact with each other, learn from each other, and help each other and live with each other, not just exist, but live with each other. So you see, one simple statement like that can lead to all kinds of other conversations.
Michelle has another conversation point. She is noting that some scientific studies note that for humans to live at sustainable levels without degrading our resources, our Earth's resources, the population shouldn't exceed 2.5 billion people, but currently the population is over 8 billion and is projected to reach 10 to 12 billion. And Michelle said she doesn't hear many scientists talking about that. This, do you advise scientists to address the problem of growth?
I do, indeed. This is the survival of the planet and the quality of life on the planet are essential parts of conversations we should have. Scientists don't talk with the public enough about this, and the public should be asking, just like Michelle is doing now. You should be asking the local high school teacher. You should be asking the college professors. You should be asking people who have programs on social media. These kinds of questions, and as I keep saying, engage in respectful conversations, respecting each other as fellow human beings, not necessarily respecting what someone is saying or what someone's ideology is, but respecting ourselves and each other so that we can really enjoy the benefits of the planet that we live on. And what we do should be for the benefit of the planet and its inhabitants, not just people, but all the inhabitants of the planet. And Larry, I should have mentioned this before. I invite everyone to visit my website where we have a variety of topics related to what we've been talking about. Sci-fun.org, SCIFUN.org. We have a rich display of material related to global warming, related to science, the arts, and the humanities. We also have, if you click in the upper left corner of the home page, experiments you can do at home. Download them and do them. They're all safe to do. Otherwise, they wouldn't post them. They've all been reviewed. They've been vetted. So I invite everyone to visit the Science is Fun website, scifun.org. And if you have suggestions for us for new topics to put or for improvements of what we have put, please let us know. Scifun.org. You're all welcome.
It's a great site. It really is. I've been there many, many times. You know, this talk about communication and working together reminds me that in late July, I believe it is, UW-Madison is going to be hosting the 2026 Biennial Conference on Chemical Education. And that's kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal because it will be the largest gathering of chemistry educators in the world coming to Madison July 26th to July 30th for a conference. It's the first time the conference comes back to Madison in 50 years. So this will be the 29th biennial conference of the American Chemical Society Chemical Education Group in Madison. In 1976, we had the conference here. It was the fourth biennial conference. It was hosted by UW-Madison, and it was a foundational and transformative conference. It offered innovative programming connecting basic research in chemistry and in educational pedagogy with faculty and teachers at all levels. And 50 years later, the conference comes back to Madison. It shines a bright light on what UW-Madison's commitment to advancing knowledge and to serving society is. And Larry, I have to say, I was the chair of the conference in 1976.
Yeah.
So here I am 50 years later, enjoying not only what the results of that conference was, but looking forward to what the conferees, the speakers, and the participants are going to do in chemistry education in the next decade. I'm forward-looking. I want to celebrate the past, of course, but I want to be focused on immediate concerns and challenges and opportunities that we have in teaching science, in this case, chemistry.
And it is at all levels. I mean, there are high school, I'm not sure about grade school. Maybe there are grade school teachers.
Oh, yeah. Yes, there are. At all educational levels. And on Sunday, the first day, July 26th, there is a symposium. The topic of it is looking forward, and it's open to the public. You don't have to pay the registration fee. It'll be held at this Wisconsin State Historical Society, on campus. There are actually two other symposia recognizing chemistry people from UW-Madison who have done well. But both of them, Kathy Middlecamp and John Moore, were at the 1976 conference. But since they have made tremendous contributions, and there's so many other, and they have a symposium for each of the, for Kathy and for John as well. They're open to the public. There's no charge for attending. And there's a commercial exhibit, all kinds of different things happening. So everyone is invited to come.
How do they do that? How do they get, do you go to scifund.org, or is there another way that people could click in to take part?
Yes, they go to Biennial Conference on Chemical Education 2026. I will also post it on my website, the scifund.org. But Biennial Conference on Chemical Education, BCCE 2026. And you'll find out a lot more, maybe, than you want to know, but it's all there. It's all there.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today. Great to have him with us as we talk science and science education. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking science and science education today with Bassam Shakashiri. Just to let you know, coming up at the top of the hour, we're certainly maintaining science as we talk about the space debris that's falling. Some of it's burning up, but a lot of it isn't. A UW Stout professor, Matthew Ray, will be joining us to talk about research going on there to actually figuring out ways to make that material that isn't burning up actually burn up before it hits the earth. So that's kind of a cool thing we'll be talking about at noon today. And then at 12:30, we'll be having an open line. You can give me your ideas for future shows. Looking forward to all that. In the meantime, we've got Greg Insaner with a question, I believe, relating to science. Greg, hello.
Hello, Larry. More of a comment than a question. Just the fellow that called in about the ham radio operator and the kids not really interested in, we old fogies got some old fogey kind of hobbies and or, lifestyles or careers. So what I'm trying to say is the kids, the last 30 years of my career, all I heard, I talked to people around the country every day, and all I seemed to hear was, kids don't want to work these days. They just don't want to work, I have to disagree with that so much, because the new technology, the new science that's out there, these kids that are 15, 18 years old now, they're so smart, it's unbelievable. And you look at the jobs, they don't want to work in grandpa's motor shop and be all full of grease anymore. The kids that are out there, the really smart, that have had their share of science and physics and chemistry and all that stuff, the jobs, just for instance, that ad you just talked about, or the next hour you talked about space, it's almost like if it was 1880 and the railroads were coming into our country, the brand new railroads, kids wanted to work on the railroads. Well, now space is being commercialized, and you look at some of these companies that are doing this stuff, the aerospace companies that we have in our country, and the jobs in their websites are just fantastic jobs for kids with master's or even bachelor's degrees. You know, they can get into a company and start in a scientific type job, and before you know it, 30 years, they're on top of the world with the commercialization of space. I can't wait to hear the next hour now with the space junk falling.
Well, Greg, thanks a lot. Comment.
Fantastic what Greg is saying. Yes, there are so many opportunities, and the level of intelligence we have in society is widespread, and we just have to find the right opportunities to pursue. And if someone is not interested in one thing, they're interested in something else, and maybe with the proper conversations at home, at the dinner table, out in the yard, also in school, in the classroom, we can try to help satisfy the curiosity that we all have. We're all curious. That's one of the lead-in statements of this program, curiosity. We all want to know, and we should expect our institutions, the schools, our community institutions, our religious groups to really encourage and help us transform to live in the 21st century and to try to take advantage of so many ways in which we can not only learn, we can contribute. It is essential for the well-being of society to become literate in science, to appreciate science, and to try to understand more about science. That's the mission of the Initiative for Science Literacy. That should be the mission of everyone who's involved in meaningful activities in the world. And as I said, having said all this, as I said before, science is not the answer to all the questions that we have. So we should learn about the important role of science, and we should, for those of us who want to be practitioners of science, we should be very good at it. We should develop skills to do it. But skills are not enough. We have to be taking responsible action to use those skills for the benefit of society. I like what Greg said, and yes, there are opportunities at different times in anyone's life where we get motivated, inspired, we change our mind about doing this, about doing that. But it is so fulfilling and so meaningful to engage in trying to satisfy our curiosity. And that is going to greatly influence the support that we get from society. So all the financial cuts that are happening now for supporting basic research and education, we have to try to change that. Why should we change it? If you don't believe and act according to what you want, then it just become indifferent. I think indifference is indifference is our enemy. We should take responsibility for what we think or what we talk about for our action. And it's all for the common good of society.
But Sam, you and I have been doing this show together for a long time. I don't even know how many shows we've done together, but...
I do.
you got a number?
It's almost 200 times.
Wow. 200 times.
Almost 200 appearances. Yes. Thank you for your hospitality and for your affording me the opportunity to visit with your listeners. You have wonderful listeners. But Larry, I have a question for you.
Oh, okay.
Is it okay to ask?
Yeah,
you a question?
Go ahead.
So, Larry, why do you do what you do? and it's a two-part question. Why do you do what you do? For decades you've done it. And what have you learned from your listeners?
Ooh. Well, you know, I'm kind of an extension person. I was first exposed to extension when I was probably 7 years old. I was in 4-H. 4-H is an extension thing, and I learned that it was fun and exciting to share information. We'd put together exhibits, we would give talks, we would do a lot of things that were focused on communicating with people, to be perfectly honest, and trying to get information across to them in a way that they would enjoy. And so I guess the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is that I enjoy that kind of work. I learned about it at a very early age, and I've really enjoyed doing this work. And you mentioned about what have I learned from listeners. I've learned that most people, no matter, I don't think their politics or their religion or background, most people are decent people. They want to learn. They're willing to share what they know. And my goodness, I can't tell you how many times people have called in with very great questions that stimulated conversations or that had answers to questions that sometimes the guests or myself didn't have an answer for. So I've learned across a whole variety of topics over my life and gotten a second PhD, I think, from my own listeners. So I guess that's my answer to that, Bassam.
That's very, very, very satisfying, enlightening, and inspiring. And it emphasizes the importance of conversations and listening. Larry, thank you so much for what you have done with this program. This is the last time you and I will speak on the air.
Yeah.
Will we speak again?
Well, I hope so. Maybe not on the air, but in person. We've done that many a time, too, over the years.
Yes, it's just a feeble attempt to be humorous here. I want you to know how much I have heard from listeners about your programs, not only when I'm on, but other programs that you have hosted and guided and invited. And the skill that you have in making everyone feel comfortable in saying what they want to say, not that you necessarily agreed with what they're saying, but so that's a tremendous characteristic, Larry. I thank you, and of course I wish you well in what you're going to do next, and maybe, just maybe, your successor will host you for a visit. Who knows?
Who knows? I'm going to close quickly with a listener comment, and that relates to a tune. You gave us a tune, and a listener cited a Joni Mitchell song called Woodstock that included the lyrics, "We are stardust, we are golden, we are billion-old carbon, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden." On that note, Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, coming up next, news. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Hey, Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to large pieces of jettison rockets and maybe some defunct satellites. Some of them have crash-landed on Earth, and we've got a lot more space junk out there than we used to have. And there's some danger associated with it. That's why we've asked Matthew Ray, Professor Matthew Ray, to join us today. He's chair of the Physics and Chemistry Department at UW-Stout. And they're doing some really interesting things relating to safety and space debris. And we'll find out all about it as we talk with him. And I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about cleaning up our skies? Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Matthew Ray, welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yes, thank you, Larry. Thank you so much for the invitation and for the opportunity to be here on the show.
You study space debris, and it comes from a the debris comes from a variety of sources, I believe.
Yes, definitely. So when you think about all these rocket launches that are occurring, sometimes the lower stages, they fall back in the ocean or come back and get caught or land. But the upper stages, as well as the payloads, well, they go into orbit. Those are out there for weeks to months to years to even decades in some cases. And so there's some legacy material that's been up there for 50 or 60 years at this point.
Well, if we look back 50 or 60 years and compare it to today in terms of the number of launches that are going on, it's got to be much, much larger today than it was, say, in 1950 or whatever.
Yes, absolutely. Things are progressing at a breakneck pace. And so thanks to a lot of the private providers such as SpaceX, Rocket Labs, Blue Origin, things are happening now in the thousands. Like last year, we had 4,500 launches worldwide, where that number used to be in only the hundreds for many decades. And so we are looking at an exponential rise in the number of things that are being launched, the number of payloads to space. And so with that comes a lot of changes, I think, that we're going to have to adjust to.
Yeah. Well, if I'm not mistaken, about 80% of active satellites, at least in low Earth orbit, are operated by Starlink, which is Elon Musk's company.
Yeah, that's correct.
And there are people who are on Starlink seem to love it, especially if they're in an area where they wouldn't be able to get the signals otherwise. But are these satellites failing to any degree, do you know?
So in general, Starlink does a pretty good job of designing their satellites so that they do burn up on reentry. There are some cases where there's a non-nominal launch, or in some cases, because of solar flares, the solar wind sometimes fluffs up the atmosphere, kind of like fluffing up your hair with a hairdryer, and makes it a little bit more puffier. And so as a result, those satellites encounter atmosphere earlier than the calculations would have otherwise suggested. And so in those cases, there have been some off-nominal Starlink satellites that have come back prematurely. I know that there was a chunk of aluminum that fell in Canada within the last couple of years because of Starlink. But overall, whenever things are going to plan, they are often coming back and going into the Pacific, which is a favorite spot to put these things that come out of orbit. You just put them in the largest center of the ocean there here on Earth. So overall, it's being managed. But the concerning part is that the current constellation is just several thousand, but there's now licenses to get up to tens, hundreds of thousands, or even the latest request is get to up to 1 million satellites in that Starlink constellation. So when you start looking at statistics, when you've got that many things up there, when things go wrong, it just increases the chance that they may land where we don't anticipate them.
Man. So is there, I mean, what happens when they, I mean, what happens to the debris that falls?
Well,
doesn't burn up.
Right. So, I mean, it just comes in hot, figuratively and literally. It's a heated piece of debris, and it just falls until it impacts Earth or the ocean. And so, you know, there's kind of a misconception out there that space is hot, and it's hot up there as it goes to the atmosphere. It's not the space that's hot. It's the fact that these materials are moving so fast. And so to achieve low Earth orbit, it's traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. And so when you think about all that energy that you see, the fire shooting out of the rocket, all that energy necessary to accelerate that payload, well, all that energy doesn't go anywhere. It stays there in the velocity of the rocket. And so, and the velocity of that payload, the satellites. And so all that energy has to go somewhere. So when that goes back into the atmosphere, it's the compression that causes that atmosphere to heat and then heat that object, that spacecraft or satellite. And so as a result of that breaking, heating, you end up usually with the material melting or decomposing or ablating away. So when these things come back in, they are partially charred, partially consumed. And if the engineering is right, it's completely consumed. But in some cases, there's an unintentional heat shield effect, especially with these composite materials that is causing things to survive at a higher rate than was originally anticipated.
Yeah, and those composite materials, I've got a bike that's, a composite bike. It's pretty light.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's far different from the earlier satellites that didn't have that material.
Right. So a priority of launch providers and people that are trying to put things in space is that cost per kilogram to get things into space. Now, SpaceX has been disruptive because of the inexpensive nature of their reusability. The cost per kilogram to space has gone down tenfold, hundredfold as we're now moving into the Starship era. And so that's quite disruptive. But it was always all about saving weight. And so where you could take a metallic object and replace it for a composite, especially a composite that's stronger, you're able to get additional satellites into space for the same cost of launch. And so that was a real game changer. And so trying to get to lighter weight in order to get more spacecraft, more satellite to orbit has been a major theme in the past several decades.
Yeah. Sandy in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sandy.
Hi there. I just wanted to share a memory about satellites going over us. I'm in my 70s, and when I was a little tiny kid, we would spend a little time at a lake, and my dad would know somehow that a satellite was scheduled to go over our area at night, and that would be a special. We could go out on the beach late at night, get all bundled up, and we'd all watch to see this little tiny light go over us, and it was very exciting. And it just makes me think how much things have changed since that time. So I just wanted to share that thought.
Yeah, Sandy, thanks. You brought to mind I have the same experience, Sandy, all those years ago, getting outside on a dark night and watching those that one satellite go overhead.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing how things have changed. You don't have to do more than just wait for about 30 seconds before your eyes defocus or focus in and you can see, oh, there's something moving north to south. That's a polar orbit. There's something moving east to west. That's definitely another. So it's no longer difficult to see a satellite. And of course, there's websites that you can find that tell you when the International Space Station is flying over. And there's also the specter of these satellite trains because of the way Starlink launches 30 to 50 satellites at the same time. They come out as a train, and as they spread out in space, it makes this very conspicuous sequence of lights, especially at dusk and dawn, where you can see those flying overhead. So yeah, it's an amazing time to be able to witness those things.
Yeah, thanks Sandy for that remembrance, because it brought back my own memories. If there's damage done, something lands on my house, who's responsible for the damage?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And so it really also highlights how things have changed. This goes all the way back to a 1972 piece of legislation, or really a treaty amongst the spacefaring nations that's called the Space Liability Convention of 1972. And so that puts the onus on the government that approves the launch And so the government that approves a launch is responsible for any damages that are done when that material comes back and hits the ground. Now, that made sense during a time when it was only nations that were launching things. Of course, the NASA, as well as the Russian space agency, yeah. Roscosmos. And so they would be on the hook for any damages if something came back and hit. However, we're now moving into this new age of private space companies. And so people are wrestling right now with what to do with that liability as well as risk. And so it still goes back to the FCC when they approve and the FAA, when they approve those launches, they then are also taking on the responsibility if something were to go sideways. But there's currently scrutiny right now looking at that space liability convention to figure out what should the next round look like.
Really interesting. And you run a materials research group at Stout, UW Stout. Talk about what that group does.
Right. So I certainly want to give a shout out to my research assistant, really at this point more accurately described as my research colleague. She's also co-author and founder and entrepreneur, Reese Huffnagel. So it's really been a collaborative effort on our part to dig into this space debris issue and try to find ways to diminish risk, how to make materials smarter so that they are strong when they need to be, when they're on mission and orbiting, but that fall apart more easily once they experience that elevated heat of reentry. She would have loved to have been here, but she's currently at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center working there this summer there in Maryland. And so she wasn't able to make it today.
Wow. So as I looked at that, I thought, well, how do you make something? I mean, when you're going up, it's gotta be strong.
Right.
And when it's coming back, then it suddenly has to be not so strong.
Yeah, it's a real challenge and one that needs to be addressed. And so there's a concept in material science for space called design for demise. And so it's not new. There's been initiatives like this for the past 20 or even 30 years. And so, the Space Debris Office at NASA, as well as the European Space Agency, prioritizes these efforts and tries to find ways to make the materials safer. So, you know, our part of that is looking at carbon fiber, because carbon fiber is often used for heat shields in intentionally making materials that will sustain the temperatures of reentry. But in the case of just using composites, the problem with this material is that it's manufactured at 3,000 Celsius or up to 5,000 Fahrenheit. And so it's manufactured at such high temperatures when you're making that filament turn into graphite that it is remarkably thermally stable. So it's sort of a properties that are along for the ride, that you want that exceptional strength as well as low weight. But with that comes that really incredible high temperature stability. So the way to address this is that you have to know the temperature profile. So when something's going to launch, as long as it's not down in that engine compartment area, it doesn't see temperatures that go above typically 1 to 200 Celsius. And so that's around the temperature that you would experience in just a regular cooking oven. And so at those temperatures on the ride uphill, that's a bit easier to plan for, because the carbon fiber is in an epoxy matrix. Think about epoxy glue. That material is quite similar to what some of those compositing materials are embedded in. So it's a really high temperature stability fiber in that polymer plastic matrix that makes up a lot of those materials. And so it's really looking at the chemistry of those composites and the carbon fiber itself, and trying to find a way to make that easier to burn up and oxidize once it gets above several hundred degrees.
Well, you know, I want to back it up a little bit and talk about your program, which I think is just a great program that you've got going there. And your kind of co-researcher, you can almost call her now. I saw an interview or a comment from her that she actually got started on this when she started as a freshman at Stout.
Yes, that's correct. She's got an incredible work ethic. She came to Stout with enough credits and already had an associate's degree as she started as a freshman. And so she joined as a chemistry major, and it was apparent that she was up to the challenge of doing some research. Her love is material science and space, and so this project is really a perfect fit because it's just that. It's both of those things combined into one. So it was really that interest and work ethic that she brought to the table that has caused this past 2 years of research to be so remarkable in terms of what we've been able to discover and accomplish.
So she's got her own business started.
Right, right. So last summer, we had some early successes in terms of some chemistries identified that to address this. And so we took our material through the NSF I-Corps program out of UW-Madison. Our mentor, Bonnie Bachman, oversees that project. And so what this does, it's a 6 to 10 week program that gets you out of the building and interviewing potential future customers through these future customer interviews. And so we interviewed 50 to 60 different entities, attended different conferences and even air shows, believe it or not. There's a great place to get in front of aerospace companies there, just trying to get a feel for the need and where the priorities are in these companies. And so after that summer, it was apparent that there was some commercializability here. And so, yeah, we started a company, Aurora Catalytic, to try to get some visibility and to push these efforts forward for Design for Demise.
It's really pretty cool. And your lab has, just to get off the topic a little bit, your lab is doing other things as well that relate to science, for sure.
Yes, of course. And so for the past 10 years, I've been doing work and research with science and even engineering students on areas of plastics, polymers, composite research is really a more recent thing. We've also done a lot of glass research. And so I'm a generalist in terms of material science that there's lots of projects from low melt point metals to fluorescent glass and emulsion polymerization projects. So yes, this composite work is really a more recent development in the past couple of years.
So there, back to the debris for a minute, there is a zero debris charter, is there not? That's kind of an international thing?
Yes, the Zero Debris Charter is really an initiative of the European Space Agency, ESA, as they call themselves, where they are trying to get companies to sign on and pledge that they will use the tenets of the Zero Debris Charter in the design of their spacecraft so that they are more sustainable. And this has to do with the materials that are used as well as the orbits that they are placed in to make sure that they are safe. There's a few different issues. And so one of the concerns is things in orbit being damaged to other things in orbit. And so there's all these maneuvers that have to happen to make sure that satellites don't collide. And really, almost secondarily, the concern is what happens when these things re-enter the atmosphere. The assumption is that they burn up. And fortunately, the Earth is 75% water. And of that 25% that remains on land, only 2% of that land is urbanized. And so most of the Earth is water or wilderness or agricultural areas. And so, you know, so far we have dodged the bullet, if you say, at least from what it's known, that whatever is reentering has been hitting somewhat unpopulated areas. But yes, that Zero Debris Charter is certainly a new legislation. There's also, it's not signed into law yet, but the U.S. Orbits Act, it was tried in the past couple of legislative cycles in 2023 and now 2025, that's when that one's headed up by Senator Hickenlooper from Colorado. But there are initiatives looking at orbit safety as well as orbit to ground safety And these pieces of legislation and efforts are certainly central at that worldwide.
And that has, I guess that has an impact on your work in many ways.
Certainly. So it definitely drives impetus on the need to find solutions, design for demise solutions to make space safer. And so it's the backdrop of the legislation, the changing liability, as well as the exponential rise in the things that are being put into space with a plan that's only going to go up by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in the next decade. It's going to be, like I said, amazing, an amazing time. And so, you know, I sort of have a cautionary posture on this.
Yeah.
I admire SpaceX, and I'm certainly not trying to stand in the way of progress. You mentioned Starlink. We vacation sometimes up in the UP, up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so Starlink is really one of the only games in town up there if you want to get internet connectivity at any good rate. And so it's a game changer for remote parts of the Earth, as well as even out in the ocean. I mean, it's amazing how it's worldwide now. And so, but we have to do this in a way that doesn't cause unnecessary risk or unknown risk to those that are here on Earth, essentially. It's been described as an unnatural disaster because, you know, when you get in a car or get in a plane, you're aware that you're taking on risk. But when you are just going about your day, you're not aware of the fact there is risk because of falling debris that right now is very low risk statistically. But what are we going to do when we come into a time in the next decade or two when it's not statistically unlikely? It's there's going to be things falling from the sky. How are we going to deal with that? And so it's the fact that you aren't necessarily a part of assuming that risk that's a concern to me. That means we have to have a higher standard of launching things into space to make sure that risk is absolutely kept at a minimum.
Yeah. Well, you're doing some amazing work. I mean, how's the company? I mean, you're started. Your company is really started, and research is ongoing, I expect.
Yes, it is. It is started. We are currently looking for partners, looking for collaborators to get these things commercialized and tested. And so we've done a lot of work with the Wisconsin Space Grant Consortium. They have been truly inspirational. Christine Boltz and Kevin Crosby there have been very supportive of both Reese's research and really pushing these things forward. We're also collaborating with Kiwi Bio out of Kenosha. And so have been in discussions with them, Todd Kapp. And so, but certainly interested in finding new ways to partner on these issues.
Well, I'm hoping that Lee Rayburn will have a chance to talk with you down the road. I think he's nodding his head right now. I can see him. He's interested to know how things progress. And Matthew, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to another visit down the road.
Yes, thank you so much, Larry, for the opportunity to be here on your show today.
Matthew Ray is a professor and chair of the Physics and Chemistry Department at UW-Stout. Not sure we've ever had back-to-back chemistry professors on the show, but they both did a really good job. And speaking of we're always looking for new topics or other topics or things that you're interested in. And we're going to be talking and getting your suggestions. So if you've got some program ideas, get your finger ready to punch in into your phone and give us a call and let us know or email us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, we talk with a lot of guests about a lot of things on this program. And sometimes we like to hear from you as to ideas. You know, you're listening, and I hope you'll let us know what you want to hear on the program. Are there topics that you are interested in? If there are topics, is there contact information or at least the name of a company or an individual who we might be able to contact to help this go move along. And if you have, think about it, if you have some topic ideas, I hope you'll join in today. The number to call, otherwise you're going to hear me talk for a half hour, and that's not what we have intended here. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Just looking ahead here. Tomorrow on the show, Scott Craven's back. Did want to mention that because Scott, it's going to be his last show. He's retiring along with me. And so we're still going to be talking about the wonderful world of wildlife. And our other regulars are going to be filling in, but Scott will be on tomorrow as his last time with us. And we'll also be taking a look at managed grazing. So in the very near future, that's what we've got. And Dave in Bluegrass, Iowa has something else. Let's go there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I was up in Wisconsin last week, but I have three Siberian Huskies, and two of them are rescues, and one we bought from a reputable breeder. But one of the issues that really gets to me is puppy mills. I don't know if that's a problem in Wisconsin, but in Iowa, I know it is. And these dogs are in horrendous conditions, and it just tears your heart apart, you know. I don't know if that's a topic you guys would even want to address or not, but the other thing is, well, here in the last few weeks, there was a research kennel in Wisconsin that was shut down.
Yep.
They had a bunch of beagles. 500 of those beagles came to a no-kill shelter here in the Quad City area. And the change in attitude of these dogs that have been placed has been awesome. But anyway, that was my suggestion. And listen, I want to wish you all the best in your retirement, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dave. And puppy mills is... And the research animals as well, the puppies, that's going to be addressed on the show, and I can actually tell you, on June 23rd, if I'm not mistaken, Patricia McConnell is going to be with us, and we're going to talk about training and such. But she's been very active, especially as it relates to the research animals. And certainly one of the, or a couple of the questions I would pose to her will relate to that, just for your own. It won't be the entire show, but it'll be something we'll be bringing up, and I'm sure it's we'll be in discussion with the team. So thank you very much for that. And appreciate it. Ron in Manitowoc, County up next. Ron, hi.
Hi, Larry. You're going to be missed.
Thank you.
Two subjects. One concerning the high cost of deer for the Wisconsin population, the crop damage, forest damage, and the 16,000 to 18,000 collisions each year with motor vehicles. And the other one would be the high cost of the use of alcohol in Wisconsin, where the taxpayer subsidizes the use of the substance and the legislative body refuses to do anything about increasing the cost to use this item.
Yeah.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. Something we did address, I think about a month ago, the alcohol use with researcher, a gal from Milwaukee who leads a group that is very interested in this particular topic. And I think we have her scheduled to come back again to talk about it. And control of the deer population, you wonder what the insurance companies auto insurance companies. They probably have they note to the dollar amount if you had them all with able to talk with them. How much money it costs not only individuals but the companies themselves, and certainly that's something that's going to be coming back up on the show. So thank you very much for that. And by the way, you can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I mentioned Scott's on the program tomorrow. On Thursday, we're going to be talking about consumer protection issues. And so kind of looking forward to that. Our folks from Ag Trade and Consumer Protection are going to be back for that, and I'm looking forward to talking with them. And also looking forward on Friday for Garden Talk to talk to Liz Freemuth, and she'll be her business is the Garden Hole, and she is always a lot of fun. It's probably my last time talking with her too, I'm guessing, and so that'll be on Friday. And I think we're also going to take a look at raised beds on Friday as well. So we've got that going for us. And on the 8th, which is next Monday, Lee's back and to talk, I believe, with our folks who are in technology. And I think they're going to take up artificial intelligence. So that's another one of those topics that's high on everybody's mind right now. And so we're looking forward to that on Monday. And Tuesday of next week, we'll be talking about, all kinds of things. We have we'll be talking about Alzheimer's disease a bit, and we'll be talking about cataracts and cataract surgeries as well. So some health topics that we will cover, along with some physical therapy issues as well, if I'm not mistaken. And I want to also mention, he hasn't been around for a while, but Bill Volkert, who is back next, a week from tomorrow, will be on to talk about birds and birding. So good topics coming up. Susie in Scandinavia called. She wants to hear an honest answer about the environmental impact of data centers. That's something that we definitely, I don't even know how much we actually know about the environmental impact of data centers. Certainly, it's going to could affect our own pocketbooks as these centers blossom around Wisconsin and around the Midwest. The latest in Lyme disease from Tick Research and mentions the Marshfield Clinic. The Marshfield Clinic is one of the great clinics that we have in the state, and they're doing a lot of research on it. Of course, it's a big issue, obviously, in rural areas, and the Marshfield Clinic serves a pretty broad range of rural areas. So another thing that we can do. Helen in New Glarus has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I am so aware that there are a lot of No Kings groups and protests in my area, in Madison, in Monroe, and across the country. I'd like to hear more about what they're about and, you know, what we think we can accomplish or what people think they can accomplish. And I think it's time to get this out in the open.
Helen, thank you very much for calling. It's something that's on a lot of people's minds, for sure. Tanya and Stevens Point will give you a chance. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Mary. How are you? I would like to just say, all the people in the world that are doing amazing things. You know, we hear about the bad politicians and one of the bad things everybody is doing. And I would like to start focusing on the positive, and people are making a difference, you know.
And unfortunately, I can't come up with too many examples here about it, but one of them would be like Mr. Beast. He's planted millions of trees and dug all those wells out in Africa and stuff. And, you know, just that, we need more hope.
Yeah.
Hope in the world, and I think,
You know, and one of the authors I'll be talking to coming up, and I can't remember the day, but I have the book right in front of me. It's titled Born to Flourish, New Science and Ancient Wisdom Reveal a Simple Path to Thriving. It's Lee just let me know. It's Monday, June 15th. And Richard Davidson is going to be the guest. And the reason we're having him, I heard him speak. And he's a great speaker and is a positive guy, I can tell you that. And his book, which I haven't read yet, I've just received it today, actually. So I'll be hitting the book pretty hard here in the next few days. Talks about thriving and how science and you know, the new stuff and the ancient stuff will reveal a simpler path to thriving, and he's written all about it. So, there you go. We'll take a quick break. I'm Larry Mueller, and then we'll get back to more of your ideas. I see now we have lots of them coming. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are taking your ideas for programs that we can host here on the Larry Mueller Show. It'll soon be the Lee Rayburn Show. And I'm sure Lee's perked his ears up, and I know Jill Nadeau is sitting with her pen in hand and making comment, writing down these suggestions as they come through. If you got some ideas, and if you have a potential guest, that always helps us as well. So if you've got a suggested guest, I would love to hear that as well. Let's go to Mary Ann in Middleton. Mary Ann, hi.
Hi. I have the idea to bring a guest to discuss citizen-led referendum. Governor Evers introduced this bill earlier in the year and had several legislators sign on. It basically allows citizens to put something on the ballot. If they have like between 4 and 5% of the total voting population in a gubernatorial election, they could put something, a referendum, on the ballot. And several special interest groups could make use of this. I'm particularly interested in gun reform, so I think that group could make use of this, but it could be used in a host of different ways for the benefit of the state and of the people that live here. The majority of states in the U.S. have it, and I think we're kind of primed to get it, but people need to learn about it. And so a show on it would be a helpful outreach effort.
Yeah.
And the suggested speaker I would have is, if he would agree to it, is the retired director, Matt Rothschild. He used to be director of Wisconsin Democracy Now! And Democracy Campaign. And he also was the editor of the Progressive magazine years ago. But he has followed this issue and can speak on it authoritatively.
Yeah, and Matt Rothschild would be a very good guest for that show. And I like that idea, Marianne. Thank you very much for calling in with it. Appreciate it. We cover a broad range of things. Irene in Janesville probably has something different. Let's go there. Hi, Irene.
Hi. I'm a proud citizen of the Wisconsin Dairy Farmers. However, they have dairy cows that give birth to male and female calves. The male calves are not treated the same way the female calves are. Female calves become cows and produce more milk. The male calves can't do that. And they aren't good for beef particularly. And they are kept in very small cages where they cannot lie down. They are chained to these small cages. They are taken from the mother cow at just a few hours after they are born, and they are not allowed to have light in their faces because then they want to move around. They struggle against because they can see again. And they are raised for veal. And it's inhumane the way they are treated.
Irene, thank you. I think I've got what you want. You're looking at the relationship here between veal, calves that are raised for veal, and the conditions under which they are raised. And that's something that could be covered in a broad context of looking at animal agriculture, for sure. So I thank you for calling, and we'll see what we can come up with in that area. Marty in Duluth, your turn.
Hey, Larry, I've been out of town for a bit. You're retiring, I hear. congratulations. When did you start broadcasting on Wisconsin Public Radio?
It was 1967.
Oh, geez. Okay.
59 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. I moved here in 89. I feel like you've been a part of almost every day of my life here in Wisconsin. So congratulations. Thank you for your calm intelligence that you have provided us over all these years. So I second the vote for data center info. The Marianne who just called in wanting Matt Rothschild, absolutely, that would be great. And if you wanted to add, get a foot reflexologist on from the Wisconsin Reflexologists Integrated Organization. I can't give you any specific names. Foot reflexology is an amazing ancient practice that has numerous health benefits, relaxation for one thing, right up there at the top of being able to provide that. Those are my suggestions. When do you head out, Larry? When's the last time we get to hear your dulcet tone?
June 30th is my last day, and I'm not sure if we're even going to have a guest that day. We might just spend a couple of hours chatting and playing some old little clips maybe and talking. So that's going to be a lot of fun. In the meantime, the month is filled with folks that I've had on in the past. And so I'm looking forward to all the conversations. Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it. And you know what? I don't think we've ever done anything on foot reflexology, as far as I can tell. So it's something we'll look into. And, of course, the others as well. I think those other topics are also great. So thank you. Scott in Windsor, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hey Larry. I'll echo the sentiments of so many that we'll miss you.
Thank you.
I have a suggestion for the show. As you know, there have been a lot of changes in WPR programming over the last year. Mm-hmm. And I would like to hear a show where readers or listeners can chime in with their reflections, impressions, and about those changes. There are some of the Saturday afternoon lineup that I surely miss, Zorba being chief among them. But there are other, even stylistic changes that I think your listeners would be happy to chime in. I know I would.
I think that can be done, as a matter of fact. And I would probably...
I don't think you need contact information for that.
Well, the first person that came to my head was Sarah Ashworth, and have Sarah on the program. Sarah is our director. She is the, I have many bosses here at Public Radio, but she is the top boss for me. And I am more than sure that she would be happy to come on the show and talk about those and answer questions from folks just like you, Scott. And she's really quite good at that. She's a direct person, but also a wonderful speaker. So rest assured that we will visit with Sarah Ashworth and get her to come on the show. Maybe she's listening. She can call in and tell me yes. Oh, man. Thanks, Scott. Jean in Portage. Hi.
Hey. I'd like to hear more about high-speed rail in Wisconsin. We now have the Borealis going from Chicago to Minneapolis, but I think there have been some other updates. Used to have a gentleman that knew where every mile of rail in Wisconsin was. I haven't heard him for a long time, but I'm sure there are some newer people.
Yeah, that was Rod Cronin, who was the commissioner of railroad. And
right.
Anybody could call, and I don't care where they were in the state, and they'd say, well, on the corner of F and 20 in such and such a county, and he's all, I know right where that is, and he would.
Yeah.
And he's passed away. But we have a new commission. We have another commissioner of railroads, or maybe someone else that the commissioner could suggest. But high-speed rail certainly is of high interest. So another one for us to look at. Thank you, Gene. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
Patricia in Madison. Hi.
Hi. So I would suggest that you have a speaker named Dr. John Whitcomb, and he is at the forefront of medical breakthrough on cell regeneration, and it's called the stuff that's called plasmalogens, and they are in the surface of every cell, and it allows the transport chain to bring oxygen and nutrients in and out of the cell, and when your plasmalogens run out, you die. So it's a very important substance, and it is being studied by Dr. Goodenow up in Saskatchewan, Canada. And Dr. John Whitcomb is the first doctor who has been trained and certified to do that treatment. And he works at Brookfield Longevity in Milwaukee. And his mobile phone number is 414-491-8315. And he's written two books. One is Fix Your Broken Brain, and that's using plasmalogens. And the other one is The Cause and Cure of Autism, which I think would be very interesting for the audience.
All right. And Patricia, I thank you so much. And thank you in particular for that information on how to get a hold of him. It's something that's going to speed that process along. I'm pretty sure of that. Thank you very much for your suggestion. And we have many more suggestions that are in emails that I haven't gotten to. And the one has to do with the marginal income tax brackets, and I'm pretty sure Jill's going to have all of this information through the emails. We'll hang on to them. So if you want to continue to do this, you can email us to talk@wpr.org. And if you've got program ideas and we didn't get them on the air, we can get them through those emails. So please go ahead and do that. Tomorrow on the show, I'm going to have fun talking with Scott Craven, his last time with us. And as always, a big thanks to our whole team, real team effort. Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill and I will be at the Barrymore Theater tomorrow night, and she'll be talking with me about my career here at WPR. Looking forward to that as well. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.